Hello, my name is Debbie Boone, and I want to welcome you to my podcast, The Bend, where we explore how successful people navigated the path and emerged in a better place when life threw them an unexpected twist. It's inspired by one of my favorite sayings, "The bend in the road is not the end of the road unless you fail to make the curve." These conversations will hopefully help you and inspire you to embrace your personal bend and to flourish. I hope you enjoy it, and if you need help with your own personal navigation and you're in veterinary medicine, please feel free to reach out to me at Debbie Boone, 2ManageVets Consulting. Enjoy the bend and be inspired by our wonderful guest. Welcome. Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's episode of The Bend, where we ask our guests to share some of the bends in the road that life throws their way. Today, my guest is Dr. Leslie Brooks, and Leslie is an associate editor at the Journal of Science, Policy, and Governance. She works in the Washington, D.C. She also has worked with the Science and Technology Policy Fellow at the U.S. AIDAAAS, Science and Technology Policy, working as a livestock advisor to the ag team within the USAID, Bureau for Humanitarian Assistance. She has been involved in One Health Outreach. She has also done some content creation and is an advocate for improving the mental and emotional health of veterinarians, as well as improving the dialogue and understanding between vets and pet owners, which I think is wonderful. So she created a forum on Facebook called Veterinary Vision 2020, where she shares content with pet owners and tries to get them collaborating with their veterinarians. And it's not a battle, right? It's a collaboration. She got her education at the University of Tennessee, where she got her BS in Animal Science, followed by Master's of Public Health, and then her DVM. So she's done a lot of stuff in her young life. And now we're going to talk about some of the bends in her road. So thanks so much, Leslie, for being with us today. I really do appreciate your time.
Well, thank you so much, Debbie. I'm glad to be here. And I love talking about bends in the road. So let's go for it.
Perfect. Well, we always have to start with the origin question. And were you one of those kids who always wanted to be the veterinarian? I know that was certainly my goal in life. And in talking to a lot of veterinarians, that's exactly what has happened. But sometimes, you know, they surprise me and they go, no, I never wanted to do that until later on. So tell me your origin story.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I was definitely that kid that loved nature and would always want to go pet the stray dog or take care of the injured wildlife on the side of the road. But I never really decided that I wanted to be a vet until I was trying to decide what I wanted to do when I went to college, once I got to that point in high school. And to be honest, I definitely felt pressured to become something that I felt society saw was important. And to me, that kind of implied a career that involved having, you know, capital letters after your name. And so I was thinking, you know, maybe I want to be a doctor. But then I had a little trepidation with that because I also have some anxiety and I was worried, you know, I hear people suing their healthcare providers all the time and, you know, all these lawsuits that happen in the medical profession. So I didn't really want to do that because I didn't want to be exposed to that kind of stress. And I also loved learning about a multitude of different things. And I thought veterinary medicine might be less stressful in the lawsuit realm, but also more impactful as far as what I can learn and contribute to, and be able to work with a variety of species seemed a lot more intriguing to me. So I went down that road.
Excellent. Well, I do hear that a lot from veterinarians that I just like the idea of looking at and working with a lot of different species. And fact, in interviewing young veterinarians, it's one of the things they're super interested in is exotics and multi-species and mixed animal hospitals. And rather than the companion animal dog cat practice, they just want they want a lot of different animals in that. So you got your master's in public health, and then you went to veterinary school.
Tell us a little bit about how life threw you a curveball. You followed a little different path. I think sometimes veterinarians think clinical practice is the hardest part of being a veterinarian, but I've talked to people who are industry vets and who are in government work, and jobs are tough no matter where you go. Depends on who you're leading.
Yeah, absolutely. By the time I finished veterinary school, I was more interested in going down the public health route of being a veterinarian than working in clinical practice. And so that's why I pursued my master's of public health at the same time. I went to the University of Tennessee, and they have a dual veterinary public health program. So I actually completed my public health degree the year before I completed my DVM. But I was also very particular that I didn't want to work in a research lab. I didn't want to do food safety. I was very intrigued with doing epidemiology, which is the study and investigation of infectious diseases. And I wanted to be able to contribute to human public health by using my expertise in animal diseases that could be transferred to people. So zoonotic diseases, kind of like COVID.
Your timing is perfect because you went right into the hot spot, so to speak, of human disease and cross transmission. So yeah, your disease background definitely was in the right place at the right time the last couple of years.
Yeah, and I was becoming a lot more engaged in the world news, and I wanted to do something humanitarian like, and I wasn't sure exactly what that was. During veterinary school, as part of my public health program, I did a internship where I went abroad to Kenya for 2 months and lived with a family in a local community and was working to try to help members of the community establish a social business enterprise to address, protein malnutrition. And so I was really trying to see how I can use my veterinary degree to have more impact and more meaning in a sense to me. Now, the curveball is that by the time I graduated, the program that I had applied to at the Centers for Disease Control, the Epidemic Intelligence Service, which I thought was the only way that I wanted to use my public health skills at the time, I actually didn't get it. I got waitlisted. I had an interview, but then I got waitlisted and was not selected for the program. And I wasn't sure what else I would want to do public health wise at the time. And people had told me, it's better to go ahead and practice clinical medicine now because it's going to be harder to go back to it years later. You're going to lose the skills, the medicine skills that you know so well now. So I did decide to go into clinical medicine right after graduating. And I did a intensive 1-year internship where, you're paid like in the 20,000s and you work really hard and rotate through different specialties. And I'm glad I did it. I learned so much and gained so much experience on client communication and also, conflict management and resolution, being able to juggle a variety of different tasks at one time. So I'm glad I did it. And then I went on and practiced in small animals, so cat and dog practice for 10 years. The first clinic I went to after my internship, I actually chose to work for them, even though they were an hour drive from where I lived, because they offered me an opportunity to have more balance in my hours that I worked. So I worked Sunday through Wednesday, and then I had Thursday through Saturday off. And that gave me so much time to do all the other things in the community that I wanted to do that was not veterinary related. So in doing that, it kind of led me to where I am now, because I had a lot of free time to volunteer with an organization in particular called the Street Outreach Animal Response Initiative in Indianapolis, Indiana. I helped to grow this nonprofit from the ground up, working with the executive director, because she saw a need in the community of people experiencing homelessness or going through a variety of life crises who happen to have pets. And so she was filling this gap, and I got on board and helped her. And it was working with these people experiencing a variety of issues and barriers in their lives. And I got intricately interconnected with the social service sector and hospital systems and working with them, that I learned of things that we have set in place in policy in the US that makes it more difficult for them to achieve resolutions to these issues. And I got involved and interested in policy by doing that throughout the past 10 years. And so now I've actually transitioned out of clinical medicine and I'm doing a science policy fellowship that I'm hoping is kind of my gateway and my stepping stone to transition into more of a work in policy and no longer doing clinical medicine.
That's that is so interesting. You know, and there's a lot of talk now about spectrum of care in veterinary medicine and the fact that we don't address lower income people and we want them to be able to have pets. But as we know, veterinary medicine has become increasingly more expensive. And that's not necessarily anything to do with the vets themselves. It has to do with the fact that we can do so much more. Because when I started in 1985, life was pretty simple in a veterinary hospital. We talked about fleas all day long. We dispensed prednisone like it was water. And we sprayed animals with Adams flea spray to try to get rid of that. And then the other thing was hit by cars because nobody looked after their animals. They just roamed freely. But today, you know, we're doing MRIs and it's so complicated comparatively. And it makes me feel for people who are new and trying to learn the profession, because there's so much more to learn than there was. And I learned it, you know, a little bit all along, and now it's dumped on you. So there's a lot, but this is certainly, you know, a timely topic, but I want to talk a little bit about, you know, it's got to be fearful to move from a known, here's the salary, here's the job, I'm very comfortable here, into the unknown of kind of a new profession and what you're doing now. So well, that curveball, tell me a little bit about like your decision-making process and how did you overcome all the fear of change, I guess, is the biggest fear we mostly have.
Yeah, no, thank you for that question. I think it's a complicated one to answer because I feel like I'm one of those people that could be a forever learner. Like if I could just stay in college my entire life and be paid for it, I would be fine with that. And so I'm okay with change. I think that fear is always there of not knowing what's going to happen. Like, what if I don't make the right decision or get a job in the right amount of time I need to be able to pay my bills? You know, like I kind of feel that right now because my fellowship ends next August. And so I'm already starting to look for jobs and opportunities and network to make sure that I have a secure position by the time this fellowship ends. So it's terrifying, but it just means that I have to put in the extra work and be brave in that face of fear. So after my internship that I had talked about and the first job I went to, I stayed there for 3 years and then I did a different big leap and chose to become an entrepreneur and work for myself. And so I established my own house call practice. You know, even though that was fearful to make that leap, I was really wanting to leave the clinic that I was at and work closer to home and have a little bit more autonomy over, you know, how I provided care and my schedule. And so I began planning for this transition. Once I made that decision, I began planning it over the course of nine to 10 months. And so, you know, I think a way to help overcome the fear is to just be very vigorous in planning and looking at all your opportunities, talk to as many people as you can, you know. And I had read an article about these three different women vets who began their own mobile clinics and it required very little overhead cost. I was like, if they did that, I can do it. And I felt empowered because at the same time at the clinic I was at, we had just hired a recent graduate, a new veterinarian. So she was constantly coming to me for advice and tips and making sure she was doing the right things. And so I was helping her a lot. And by mentoring her and helping her, it showed me that I had what it takes. And it provided me that level of confidence that I needed to finally go out on my own. And so I did. And I talked to, you know, another veterinarian in my area that had her own mobile clinic. And she was like, yeah, come on, we need more mobile clinics because this is a high demand right now for our community. And so, you know, I talked to as many people as I could. So I, you know, I ran my own business for 3 years and was also helping this nonprofit on the side as well. And then, you know, when I decided getting into policy was going to be my transition out of clinical medicine, I researched and mapped out and, you know, learned about anything and everything I could to make the transition successful, as scary as it was. But to be honest, I think the scariest thing for me would have been staying and doing something that I feared I would be doing my entire life and not be happy. And not feel like I was making the impact that I needed. And, you know, all the stresses and anxieties that were associated with it, that I would continue doing something, taking away time from my child. You know, I have a 5-year-old now, so he was younger then. And feeling like all that time away from him and all the effort I was doing, I didn't truly value it and feel passionate about it. I think that was probably more of a fear to me making a change to find something that I really, really love as a veterinarian.
You know, I think that's just such a good point, is that if you really love what you're doing, then the time commitment doesn't matter because you enjoy what you're doing. But if you think this is not my passion in life, this is not the thing that gets me up and out of bed every single morning, it's something I can do, but I don't love to do it, then it's okay to make that change. And the prep work that you did, I think, is the wise part. It's like you talk to people and you got your cushion of cash so that, you know, you could make that leap and still pay your bills. And I think that's one of the challenges that a lot of people face when they are ready to make a transition, but they're trapped into where they are because they didn't really strategically plan how they were going to get out of it if they needed to. I know, you know, from my own situation, when I was working in practices as the chief operating officer of a very large hospital, I was laid off during the 2008 recession. But I had always been slightly doing consulting. It was just a little on the side. You know, everybody has a side gig in vet med, right? So this was my on the side gig. And I'd always wanted to do it full time, but I had an opportunity that came along because I had a husband who was working and supportive. I had unemployment that had been extended for a long period of time because of the recession. And so it gave me opportunity to build kind of a group of products that I would go and I could do presentations out. So it was a time that I had kind of a cushion of safety to be able to go out and do that. And I think that's made all the difference in the world. Obviously, I'm still doing it 16 years later, so it worked out for me. But that's just one of those curveballs in life. So obviously this decision is working out well for you, but looking back on your career, what do you consider to be your biggest career mistake? Something you wish you had not done?
Oh, well, I am not sure about that because I'm someone that tends to look at things through a glass half full for better or worse. And so even something that I might have felt was like a wrong decision or a mistake, I ultimately end up looking at it as like, I'm really glad that happened. And I feel like that happened for a reason, whether because I turned it into that or it helped me develop some kind of skill set or opportunity that came from it. But I think that that's really hard for me to answer because the things that I chose throughout my career, it also was tied into my personal life and like my decisions with my personal life and family, you know, getting the timing of getting married, the timing of having a kid, they are intricately connected. And so I feel like if I didn't have a family and I didn't have a kid, I probably would have had other opportunities or taken advantage of other opportunities career-wise. And I don't know what would have happened or gone, but I also don't ever want to not have my family. And so, you know, I think I can see it as like, I might've, you know, chosen a job where I traveled abroad and lived abroad somewhere, doing some bizarre veterinary work in the field, like with veterinarians without borders or something. But every decision I made here, it had to be intricately tied, you know, to my personal life and family. And so I don't think that I, you know, there were any mistakes. I will say, I really wish I got that job at the Centers for Disease Control. And so if I had prepared better for my interview with them, because I actually, after I started my role after my internship at the general practice clinic, I did reapply for the Centers for Disease Control Epidemic Intelligence Service 3 years later. And the same thing happened again. I got an interview and then got waitlisted and didn't get it. And so I'm wondering if, you know, I could have prepared a little bit better for that interview and studied up more on all that epidemiology schooling I had. You know, then, you know, I think that was probably the primary mistake.
Yeah. If you look back and go, you know what, I would think now, I'm looking back on my career, like there were places that I thought I should go and wanted to do and things that I would take an opportunity. And I look back on it and go, no, that wasn't where I was supposed to end up. Because if I had done that, I would not have done this other thing, which led to this next thing and the next thing and the next thing. So I really do believe that the universe puts you where you're supposed to be and the people in front of you who are supposed to be there at any particular time. And I've kind of gone with the flow my whole life and said, okay, this is how it's supposed to be. And you're right. I mean, even the bad things that happen sometimes turn out to be learning experiences that give you a skill set that help you move on to the next thing. And so I'm sure that, you know, those years in clinical practice and even the mentoring that you did probably gave you a skill set that you're helpful today with the work that you're doing. Talking about networking, now you're working on, you know, this new goal. Is networking valuable to you in getting you where you want to be? Or are you one of those people who works to network?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I did this when I decided I wanted to go into like transition into policy. I actually started having meetings and they were so kind to meet with me, but with my city council person in Indianapolis, Indiana, and with a state senator and his staff to see how I as a veterinarian can get involved in their office. And, you know, even if it was that I applied to do an internship that was intended for like college students, and I'm, you know, in my 30s, I was willing to do that. But then COVID happened and they canceled their internship programs. But I knew that I was gonna apply for this science policy fellowship, which is for people with scientific backgrounds to work in the federal government for 2 years. And it's through the American Academy for the Advancement of Science. I knew I was going to apply for that. And so I went ahead and applied for that. And right when you get in, you know, they tell you one of the major parts of this fellowship is it's a great networking opportunity to meet so many different people that are working in the federal government on the executive branch side and the legislative branch side. And, you know, the whole purpose of the fellowship, aside from your regular duties in your office, is to engage in networking on a day-to-day basis and professional development opportunities so that hopefully you'll, if you want, then you can maintain a position at some level of government or nonprofit or something after the fellowship. So throughout, yeah, it is. And it's not networking in the sense of what can you provide for me? I rub your back, you rub me, but like that you learn, you have the opportunity to learn so many new things and learn of so many different programs and opportunities to be engaged and decide what you want to do once the fellowship is over. I mean, I do feel like a day-to-day of my work is networking.
Well. You know, that's true. I mean, the opportunities that are out there, there's so many and people don't know how to find those opportunities. So I do think that sometimes, you know, it's not what you know and where the opportunities lie that are interesting to you. But I am curious, like you got this fellowship and for veterinarians or anybody out there in the world who's interested in moving out of clinical practice and doing something in policy, tell me how you find those things. Where do you go to look?
Yeah, mine was kind of happenstance because I was at the American Veterinary Medical Association annual meeting to get my continuing education. And it happened to be in Washington, D.C. And I love Washington, D.C. But it was up here in, it was before COVID. I think it was 2019 because it was, yeah, it was a few months before COVID started. So I came to that conference in 2019 and I was in the area where people set up booths and, you know, you learn about different products and programs. And I happened to walk by AAAS, their Science and Technology Policy Fellowship informational booth. And, you know, previous years that I probably would have walked on by, like I didn't have even registered in my mind that that's something I should learn about. But because I was already in that frame of mind of I want to transition to policy, I saw it and it captured my attention. And I talked to the lady there and I said, this is what I'm going to do. This is going to be my foot in the door and my way in. Because like you said, policy definitely is about who you know in this country.
Yes.
So so that's how I learned about it. It was at the AVMA conference. And I think the only reason I paid attention to it is because that's where, you know, my vision was on. Mm-hmm. You know, if I hadn't been in that ready state of mind to seek that out, I wouldn't have paid any attention to it.
Walk past that booth. Well, that's, you know, that's really interesting because I'm with you. I mean, I actually attended at AVMA. And I remember it well because I was at a Vet Partners meeting, which is consultants and advisors to the profession, the days before that. And 27 of us got norovirus. So believe me, I remember that AVMA well. I had 4 hours of lecture to give, and I thought I was going to pass out at the podium. I had water bottles lined up, and I was hanging on to the podium. And I said, you know, if I faint, I hope there's a doctor in this room because this is what's going on. But so it sticks out of my mind, definitely in Washington, D.C. So interesting. Did they coach you through the possibility of what, like, here's what I'm interested in, here's a fellowship in this, when you got connected?
Well, I ended up at the U.S. Agency for International Development because it's a long application process for this fellowship, and you can apply it to be on the legislative side or the executive branch side. And I applied to both. The legislative side I didn't get, but I got accepted into the executive branch side. So once you get accepted, then you have it's kind of like, what do they call it? Like a dating, we're at the table and you like speed date. It's kind of like speed dating. So they have like a week where you interview with teams from a variety of federal agencies, you know, everything from Veterans Affairs to Housing and Urban Development to Health and Human Services, the National Institutes of Health, US and USAID. And then, you know, based on these interviews, they rank you as an applicant and you rank them as, you know, an office where you might want to work. And then it's kind of a matching process. And so you get matched. And so I happened to get matched at USAID and I loved it. Yeah. And there's a lot of veterinarians actually that work at USAID that I had no idea about. And they're doing, you know, wonderful work serving as, you know, technical experts. And so it's been a eye-opening experience and a lot of learning.
You know, I love this conversation because so many times I talk to young people and I've done some talks at the schools to the pre-vet curriculum, and these kids really don't think that there's anything out there other than clinical work. That's their kind of their mindset for what being a veterinarian is. But there's so many opportunities like you're presenting here with all these different government agencies where they can work, and there's research and there's pharmaceuticals and, you know, it just, there's a lot you can do with a veterinary degree that I think people don't really understand. But I would like to ask you this because I have the impression a lot of times doctors that are in clinical work think, oh, if I could only get out of some place that I face the public every day, life is just going to be a piece of cake, right? It's a cakewalk. But, you know, I've interviewed some people, actually, I interviewed somebody who worked in the CDC. And it was a very toxic workplace, the department where she was, and it was very traumatic to her. So it really is where you are and the people who are around you, not the place that you work. It is the people you work with. Would you agree with that? Or do you feel like there's, you know, it's easier to work in a government atmosphere? Is it harder? Is it just different?
Yeah, no, I would definitely agree with that. I mean, even though I don't interact with the like clients on a daily basis, like I would when I was, you know, in clinical medicine, you know, we're definitely interacting with implementing partners, you know, partners that we're funding to carry out programming around the world. And it's still using those, you know, those same skills of collaboration, communication, and coordinating to get a good outcome. And so just using them in a different way. Now, having a supportive environment of people that, you know, they got your back and they're there to help you and mentor you and help, you know, work collaboratively, I think that that does make a huge difference, making it a welcoming and low stress environment. I mean, in the clinic, I would say this might be a bit different from some veterinarians, but I enjoy working with an angry client because I like trying to find that resolution and, you know, bring them down. Like my, when I first got out and was practicing clinical medicine, I definitely had those days where if I felt offended by a client or I didn't feel like they were, you know, respecting me because I look young, right? I would do something not very proud that I'm not very proud of. And, you know, I would, you know, say, well, you can go somewhere else. Or, you know, I just wouldn't respond appropriately. And it took years of just interacting with people and just growing my own self-confidence to let those things roll off of my shoulder and be better at conflict resolution. And then I felt so much more accomplished when I interacted with a client that was maybe like up here. And by me stepping back and just listening to them, they came down to here. And I remember one situation in particular where once it was done, you know, my receptionist was like, wow, that was very impressive. And like, and I was like, yeah, it was.
Yeah. Well, it was, yeah, for years and years, I taught a communication class for Patterson Veterinary Supply. And I used to say and confess, I love dealing with difficult clients. And people would laugh at me, but there was always two or three in the room that go, yeah, me too, because it's a skill set. You know, anybody can be nice to nice people. That's a cakewalk and it's really kind of boring. But when you have somebody who's a challenge and you bring all those skills that you've learned to bear, and like you said, it works out. You're walking them down the ledge and getting them to a reasonable place. Then you walk away from that going, you know, I'm pretty good at this. And the client's good. You know, the client's happy too. So you've it's a win-win on both sides of the coin. But I agree with you. Yeah, those spicy clients. Now, recently, I think post-COVID, people are off the rails on both sides. And a lot of times I tell the teams, I said, I know the clients are difficult, but you got to understand you're just as tired as they are. And a part of it's you too. So it's both of us are just have been beat up by the pandemic and all the, you know, social unrest and just hammered. And now we have a war. I mean, there's just so much that's happened to us in the last 2 to 3 years that is unsettling. And people above all things don't like change. They like to feel safe. They like to, you know, be sure that the status quo maintains until they choose to change it. But we've been bombarded with change, not made us very happy. So what advice would you give somebody who's facing this big career decision, who's looking to move to something they've always wanted to do or something new and something different?
Yeah, it definitely depends on what kind of personal and social supports you have, because it definitely, the different dynamics play out depending on people's different life circumstances. Do the background research, you know, before making the leap, try to really explore what opportunities are out there and what kind of supports you can seek out to help in the transition and talk to people. It might be scary. I know sometimes I don't want to always tell people my plans because then I feel like I must act on them or I'm a failure if they don't come to fruition. But I think people are much more understanding and forgiving on that stuff than we think. You know, if you don't end up doing it, it's really not that big of a deal. But talk to as many people as you can, because you never know who might have a contact or a helpful resource or something that they wouldn't have shared with you if they had no idea of what you wanted to do.
Yeah.
And I think it's worth it, you know, taking that leap, as long as you feel you know, supported personally and socially.
Yeah. You know, and that's an excellent point, is you go ahead and tell people what you know, what your plans are, what you'd like to do out there in the world, because people like to help. And I think that's something that we miss, realizing that, you know, we think, oh, well, I don't want to impose on anybody. I don't want to ask them for help. But truthfully, as human beings, we're very collaborative by nature. And when we can help somebody else within our group, then it makes us feel good too. So it's a win-win on both sides to be able to help somebody that you like, even if you don't know them very well. You know, I love matchmaking. I love putting partnerships together and like, oh, you should talk to this person over here. And in fact, I've already thought about somebody for you. So I'm going to talk to you about animal policy group, because I think you might be a good fit there. But yeah, so do ask people, you know, reach out and ask people. You don't have to know them really well. And sometimes that's even better, that you don't know them really well, because they're not going to say, oh, you know, they're not going to put you down. Oh, don't do that. You know, you can't possibly do that, because strangers are sometimes more supportive than the closest people around us who know us the best. So tell us a fun fact about you, Leslie. Do you have a favorite talent or a favorite song or something that people would be surprised to know about?
Well, I used to be a hip hop dance teacher.
That's a great talent.
When I was in undergraduate at the University of Tennessee, I used to teach a hip hop class at our gym as like a, you know, they have yoga classes and cycling classes. And so I taught hip hop with my roommate and really good friend at the time, because I danced all throughout my childhood and youth, and I love hip hop. So that was probably my first entrepreneurship activity, because we actually got this class established at our gym. It was very new.
Well, it sounds like fun. You know, I found out that Karen Felsted wanted to be a ballerina when I had her on the podcast. So now I've had a hip hop dancer on too. So that's great. Leslie, I appreciate your time today. And I think it's been an interesting conversation for people who are looking outside of the traditional clinical path for veterinary medicine. And, you know, this goes the same for technicians, for SARs, for managers. You can do non-traditional things and still be successful in this career without having to leave the profession. I think we are, you know, we're kind of suffering at that point right now where people go, oh, vet med is broken. I've got to leave it. But there's other possibilities that you'll use your knowledge and your talents. And especially when you're talking about policy, this is the health of our country and the health of the animals in our country too. So very important work that you're doing. And I thank you for that. Anything you'd like to say about yourself, or do you have a favorite book you'd like to share, or a favorite quote, or even a shout out to somebody that, you know, has helped you up that career ladder?
Well, a few things, and then I'll sign off. Yeah, shout outs to people who have helped me. You know, some of my professors and mentors at the University of Tennessee, definitely Dr. Elizabeth Strand, who started the veterinary social work program, Dr. Marcy Souza, and then Dr. John New, who he has passed now, but he was integral, is that a word? Very important in getting me interested in serving underserved and vulnerable populations. And then Dr. Reed Harvey, who has been a mentor and colleague throughout my veterinary medicine career and has wrote me multiple recommendation letters for things. A few things I'm doing right now, that when I was doing my house call practice, a lot of the requests I would get were for euthanasias. And so I've done a ton of euthanasias, and they've gone a variety of different ways and for a variety of different reasons. And so I'm trying to slowly but progressively put together a compilation book of just different euthanasia stories, because I don't think it's something that we talk about enough for the general public to understand really what goes into it. And I personally had a lot of anxiety surrounding euthanasia, even though it was something I did multiple times a day. So I'm working on that. If anyone wants to contribute or send excerpts, you know, I'm welcome to those. Mine are mostly focused on dogs and cats, so anything with other species would be great. And then one of my ultimate long-term goals, even though I don't want to practice clinical medicine again, I would love to be a medical director of an official One Health clinic, like a permanent structured clinic that has veterinarians, human doctors, social workers, all the stuff in one place, and where we serve a variety of folks of different socioeconomic backgrounds. So that's, you know, one of my long-term goals is being a medical director of that. So looking forward to figure out how to make that happen.
Yeah, that is really a very cool thing. You know, I think we've come a long way understanding the importance that animals have to people who are completely disrupted from life, in that they moved into, you know, homeless situations, and the fact even battered women that we now realize that people need to take their animals with them. It's one of the reasons that women stay in bad situations, is they're afraid that their animals can't come to shelters with them. So I think that animal policy people like you have probably shined a light on that. We've had some veterinarians who actually are members of Congress, and that I'm sure that they're doing the same thing, and the importance of animals in the lives of people, and how even if you are basically destitute, there's nothing like a dog to make you feel better. And that's a very important thing that we need to get together with. So I appreciate the work that you're doing there, and I look forward to seeing like the next step when you move out of this this fellowship and do some more great work. And I agree with the shout out to Dr. Strand starting that social work program. Has been an invaluable tool. It's something I reference a lot when helping people. So yeah, and she's also done some work with another guest of mine, Addie Reinhold. Addie started Mentor Vet, which helps first and graduates in their first job with mentoring them with experienced veterinarians who can help them through, you know, death week, which happens to us all, and get them through that. And it's been very successful. So I think this is we're moving towards the right direction. There's a lot of emotion in veterinary medicine that's human emotion that we need to be better at managing. So I thank you very much for your time today, Leslie, and the information about how to get in touch with you in the show notes. So thanks again, and have a great rest of the day.
Thank you so much, Debbie.